There were bits of rotten straw there still, and on her back, to which I shifted both hands a moment later.
Severian, I love you. I longed for you when we were together and tried to give myself to you a score of times. Don't you remember the Garden of Delectation? How much I wanted to take you there. It would have been rapture for us both, but you wouldn't go. For once, be honest.
She spoke as if honesty were an abnormality like mania.
Don't you love me? Take me now. Here. Agilis will turn his face away, I promise you.
Her fingers had slid between my waistband and my belly, and I was not aware that her other hand had lifted the flap of my sabretache until I heard the rustle of paper there. I slapped her wrist, perhaps harder than I should, and she flew at me, clawing for my eyes as Thekla used sometimes to do when she could no longer bear the thoughts of imprisonment and pain. I pushed her away, not into the chair this time, but against the wall. Her head struck the stone, and though it must have been padded by her abundant hair, the sound was as sharp as the tap of a mason's hammer. All the strength seemed to leave her knees. She slid down until she was sitting on the straw. I would never have guessed that Agia was capable of weeping, but she wept. Agilis asked, "What did she do?" There was no emotion beyond curiosity in the question. "You must have seen her." She tried to reach into my sabretache. I scooped what coins I possessed out of their compartment. 2 brass orichalks and 7 copper E's. Or perhaps she wanted to steal the letter I have to the Archon of Thrax. I told her about that once. But I don't carry it in here. She wanted the coins, I am sure. They fed me, but she must be dreadfully hungry. I picked Agia up and thrust her torn gown into her arms, then opened the door and let her out. She was still dazed, but when I gave her an orichalk, she threw it down and spat at it. When I re-entered the cell, Agilis was sitting cross-legged, his back propped by the wall. "Don't ask me about Agia," he said. "Everything you suspect is true. Is that enough? I will be dead tomorrow, and she will wed the old man who dotes on her or someone else. I wanted her to do it sooner. He couldn't have prevented her from seeing me, her brother. Now, I will be gone, and she won't have even that to worry about."
"Yes," I said. "You will die tomorrow. That's what I've come to talk to you about. Do you care how you look on the scaffold?"
He stared at his hands, slender and rather soft, where they lay in the narrow beam of sunlight that had given his head. An Agia's, an aureole a few moments before.
"Yes," he said. "She may come. I hope she won't, but yes, I care."
I told him then, as I had been taught, to eat little in the morning, so that he would not be ill when the time came, and cautioned him to empty his bladder, which relaxes at the stroke. I drilled him, too, in that false routine we teach to all who must die, so they will think the moment has not quite come when in fact it has come. The false routine that lets them die with something less of fear. I do not know if he believed me, though I hope he did. If ever a lie is justified in the sight of the Pan-Creator, it is that one. When I left him, the orichalk was gone. In its place, and no doubt with its edge, a design had been scratched on the filthy stones. It might have been the snarling face of Jurupari, or perhaps a map, and it was wreathed with letters I did not know. I rubbed it away with my foot. Chapter 30 Night. There were five of them, three men and two women. They waited outside the door, in a sense, but not near it, grouped a dozen strides away. Waiting, they talked among themselves, two or three talking together, almost shouting, laughing, waving arms, nudging one another. I watched them from the shadows for a time. They could not see me there, or did not, wrapped as I was in my Fuligian cloak. And I was able to pretend I did not know what they were. They might have been at a party, all a little drunk. They came eagerly yet hesitantly, afraid of being repulsed and determined to make the advance. One man was taller than I, surely the illegitimate son of some exultant, 50 or more, and nearly as fat as the host of the Inn of Lost Loves. A thin woman of 20 or so walked beside him, almost pressing against him. She had the hungriest eyes I have ever seen. When the fat man stepped in front of me, blocking my way with his bulk, she nearly, yet not quite, embraced me, coming so close it seemed almost magical that we did not touch, her long-fingered hands moving at the opening of my cloak with the desire to stroke my chest, but never quite doing so, so that I felt I was about to fall prey to some blood-drinking ghost, a succubus or lamia. The others crowded around me, hemming me against the building. "It's tomorrow, isn't it? How does it feel? What's your real name? He's a bad one, isn't he? A monster." None of them waited for answers to their questions, or, so far as I could see, expected or wanted any. They sought propinquity, and the experience of having spoken to me. "Will you break him first? Will there be a branding? Have you ever killed a woman?" "Yes," I said. "Yes, I did, once." One of the men, short and slight, with the high bumpy forehead of an intellectual, was putting an assegai into my hand. "I know you fellows don't get much, and I hear he's a pauper. Can't tip." A woman, gray hair straggling over her face, tried to make me take a lace-trimmed handkerchief. "Get blood on it, as much as you want, or even only a little. I'll pay you afterward." All of them stirred me to pity, even as they revolted me. But one man most of all. He was even smaller than the one who had given me the money, grayer than the gray-haired woman. And there was a madness in his dull eyes, a shadow of some half-suppressed concern that had worn itself out in the prison of his mind until all its eagerness was gone and only its energy remained. He seemed to be waiting until the other four had finished speaking, and since that time clearly would never come, I quieted them with a gesture and asked him what he wanted.
"Master, when I was on the Quasar, I had a paracoida, a doll, you see, a genicon. So beautiful with her great pupils, as dark as wells, her irises, purple like asters or pansies blooming in summer. Master, whole beds of them, I thought, had been gathered to make those eyes, that flesh, that always felt sun-warmed. Where is she now? My own Scopolania, my poppet. Let hooks be buried in the hands that took her. Crush them, master, beneath stones. Where has she gone from the lemon wood box I made for her, where she never slept at all? For she lay with me all night, not in the box, the lemon wood box where she waited all day, watch and watch, master, smiling when I laid her in so she might smile when I drew her out. How soft her hands were, her little hands, like doves. She might have flown with them about the cabin had she not chosen instead to lie with me. Wind their guts about your windlass, stuff their eyes into their mouths, unman them, shave them clean below so their doxies may not know them, their lemons may rebuke them, leave them to the brazen laughter of the brazen mouths of strumpets. Work your will upon those guilty. Where was their mercy on the innocent? When did they tremble? When weep? What kind of men could do as they have done? Thieves. False friends. Betrayers. Bad shipmates, no shipmates. Murderers and kidnappers. Without you, where are their nightmares? Where are their restitutions so long promised? Where are their chains, fetters, manacles, and kings? Where are their abominations that shall leave them blind? Where are the defenestrations that shall break their bones? Where is the estrapod that shall grind their joints? Where is she, the beloved whom I lost?
Dorcas had found a daisy for her hair, but as we walked about outside the walls, I wrapped in my cloak so that to anyone more than a few paces off it must have seemed that she walked alone. It folded its petals in sleep, and she plucked instead one of those white trumpet-shaped blossoms that are called moonflowers, because they appear green in the moon's green light. Neither of us had much to say, other than that we would be utterly alone, save for the other. Our hands spoke of that, clasping each other tightly. Vidalers came and went, for the soldiers were making ready to depart. To north and east the wall hemmed us around, making the wall that enclosed the barracks and administrative buildings seem no more than children's work, a wall of sand that might be trodden down by accident. To south and west extended the sanguinary field. We heard the trumpet blown there, and the cries of the new Monomachists who sought their foes. Both of us, I think, for a time, dreaded that the other would suggest we walk there and watch the combats. Neither did. When the last curfew had come drifting down from the wall, we returned, with a borrowed candle, to our windowless and fireless room. There was no bolt for the door, but we put the table against it and stood the candlestick on that. I had told Dorcas she was free to go, and that forever afterward it would be said of her that she was a torturer's woman, who gave herself under the scaffold for money spotted with blood. She had said, "That money has clothed and fed me." Now she drew off the brown mantle which hung to her heels and beyond when she was not careful of it, so the hem dragged in the dust, and smoothed the raw, yellow-brown linen of her samar. I asked if she were frightened.
"Yes," she said.
Then quickly,
"Oh, not of you."
"Of what, then?" I was taking off my clothes. If she had asked me, I would not have touched her throughout the night. But I wanted her to ask. Indeed, I wanted her to beg. And the pleasure I would have had in abstinence would then have been at least as great as I thought, as I would have had in possession, with the additional pleasure of knowing that on the next night she would feel the more obliged because I had spared her.
"Of myself. Of what thoughts may return to me when I lie again with a man?"
"Again? Do you remember a time before?" Dorcas shook her head.
"But I am certain I am no virgin. I have desired you often, yesterday and today. For whom did you believe I washed myself? Last night I held your hand while you slept, and I dreamed we sated ourselves and lay in each other's arms. But I know satiety as well as desire. So I have known one man at least. Do you wish me to remove this before I blow out the candle?
She was slender, high-breasted, and narrow-hipped, strangely childlike to me, though fully a woman.
You seem so small, I said, and held her to me.
And you are so big.
I knew then that however much I tried not to, I would hurt her, that night and afterward. I knew, too, that I was incapable of sparing her. A moment before, I would have refrained if she had asked. Now, I could not. And just as I would have thrust forward, though it had plunged my body on a spike, I would follow her later and try to cleave her to me. But it was not my body that was impaled, but hers. We had been standing while I ran my hands over her and kissed her breasts, that were like round fruit sliced in two. Now I lifted her, and together we fell on one of the beds. She cried out, half in delight, half in pain, and pushed me away before she clutched at me.
I'm glad, she said. I'm so glad,
and bit me on the shoulder. Her body bent backward like a bow. Later we pushed the beds together so we could lie side by side. Everything was slower the second time. She would not agree to a third.
You'll need your strength tomorrow, she said.
Then you don't care.
If we could have our way, no man would have to go roving or draw blood. But women did not make the world. All of you are torturers, one way or another.
It rained that night, so hard we could hear it drumming on the tiles of our heads, a cleansing, crashing, unending downpour of water. I dozed and dreamed that the world had been turned upside down. Guyall was overhead now, decanting all its flood of fish and filth and flowers over us. I saw the great face I had seen under the water when I had nearly drowned, a portent of coral and white seen in the sky, smiling with needle teeth. Thrax is called the city of windowless rooms. This windowless room of ours, I thought, is a preparation for Thrax. Thrax will be like this. Or perhaps Dorcas and I are already there. It was not so far north as I thought. So far north as I was led to believe. Dorcas got up to go out, and I went with her, knowing it would not be safe for her to go alone at night in a place where there were so many soldiers. The corridor outside our room ran along an outer wall, pierced with embrasures. Water splashed through each in a fine spray. I wanted to keep Terminus Est in her sheath, but so large a sword is slow to draw. When we were back in our room again, with the table against the door, I took out the whetstone and sharpened the man side of the blade, honing its edge unto the endmost third, the part I would use, would divide a thread tossed into the air. Then I wiped and oiled the whole blade and stood the sword against the wall near my head. Tomorrow would be my first appearance on the scaffold, unless the Kiliarch decided at the last moment to exercise clemency. That was always a possibility, always a risk. History shows that every age has some unquestioned neurosis. And Master Palaemon had taught me that clemency is ours, a way of saying that one less one is more than nothing. That since human law need not be self-consistent, justice need not be so either. There is a dialogue in the Brown Book somewhere between two mists, in which one argues that culture was an outgrowth of the vision of the increate as logical and just, bound by interior consistency to fulfill his promises and threats. If that was the case, I thought, surely we will perish now, and the invasion from the north that so many have died to resist is no more than the wind that topples a tree already rotten. Justice is a high thing. And that night, when I lay beside Dorcas listening to the rain, I was young, so that I desired high things only. That, I think, was why I so desired that our guild regained the position and regard it had once possessed. And I still desired that, even then, when I had been cast out of it. Perhaps it was for the same reason that the love of living things, which I had felt so strongly as a child, had declined until it was hardly more than a memory when I found poor Triskel bleeding outside the Bear Tower. Life, after all, is not a high thing, and in many ways is the reverse of purity. I am wise now, if not much older, and I know it is better to have all things, high and low, than to have the high only. Unless the Kiliarch decided then to grant clemency, tomorrow I would take Agilis's life. No one can say what that means.
The body is a colony of cells. I used to think of our oubliette when Master Palaemon said that. Divided into two major parts, it perishes.
But there is no reason to mourn the destruction of a colony of cells. Such a colony dies each time a loaf of bread goes into the oven. If a man is no more than such a colony, a man is nothing. But we know instinctively that a man is more. What happens then to that part that is more? It may be that it perishes as well, though more slowly. There are a great many haunted buildings, tunnels, and bridges. Yet I have heard that in those cases in which the spirit is that of a human being and not an elemental, its appearances grow less and less frequent, and at last cease. Historiographers say that in the remote past, men knew only this one world of earth, and had no fear of such beasts as were on it then, and traveled freely from this continent to the north. But no one has ever seen even the ghosts of such men. It may be that it perishes at once, or that it wanders among the constellations. This earth surely is less than a village in the immensity of the universe. And if a man lives in a village and his neighbors burn his house, he leaves the place if he does not die in it. But then, we must ask how he came. Master Gerlos, who has performed a great many executions, used to say that only a fool worried about making some failure of ritual, slipping in the blood, or failing to perceive that the client wore a wig and attempting to lift a head by the hair. The greater dangers were a loss of nerve that would make one's arms tremble and give an awkward blow, and a feeling of vindictiveness that would transform the act of justice into mere revenge. Before I slept again, I tried to steel myself against both. Chapter 31. The Shadow of the Torturer. It is a part of our office to stand uncloaked, masked, sword-bared, upon the scaffold for a long time before the client is brought out. Some say this is to symbolize the unsleeping omnipresence of justice, but I believe the real reason is to give the crowd a focus and the feeling that something is about to take place. A crowd is not the sum of the individuals who compose it. Rather,
It is a species of animal, without language or real consciousness, born when they gather, dying when they depart. Before the Hall of Justice, a ring of demarchi surrounded the scaffold with their lances, and the pistol their officer carried could, I suppose, have killed 50 or 60 before someone could snatch it from him and knock him to the cobblestones to die. Still, it is better to have a focus, and some open symbol of power. The people who had come to see the execution were by no means all, or even mostly, poor. The sanguinary field is near one of the better quarters of the city, and I saw plenty of red and yellow silk, and faces that had been washed with scented soap that morning. Dorcas and I had splashed ourselves at the well in the courtyard. Such people are much slower to violence than the poor, but once roused, are far more dangerous, because they are not accustomed to being overawed by force, and, despite the demagogues, have a good deal more courage. And so I stood with my hands resting on the quillions of Terminus Est, and turned this way and that, and adjusted the block so that my shadow would fall across it. The Kiliarch was not visible, though I discovered later that he was watching from a window. I looked for Agia in the crowd, but could not find her. Dorcas was on the steps of the Hall of Justice, a position reserved for her at my request by the Port Reeve. The fat man who had waylaid me the day before was as near the scaffold as he could get, with a lance fire threatening his bulging coat. The woman of the hungry eyes was on his right, and the gray-haired woman on his left. I had her handkerchief in my boot top. The short man who had given me an azami, and the dull-eyed man who stammered and talked so strangely were nowhere to be seen. I looked for them on the rooftops, where they could have had a good view despite their small stature. And though I did not find them, perhaps they were there. Four sergeants in high dress helmets led Agilis forth. I saw the crowd opening for them like the water behind Hildegrin's boat before I could see them at all. Then came the scarlet plumes, then the flash of armor, and at last Agilis's brown hair and his wide, boyish face held up-tilted because the chains that bound his arms forced his shoulder blades together. I remembered how elegant he had looked in the armor of a guard's officer, but the golden chimera splashed across his chest. It seemed tragic that he could not be accompanied now by men of the unit that had in some sense been his, instead of these scarred regulars in laboriously polished steel. He had been stripped of all his finery now, and I waited to receive him, wearing the Fuligen mask in which I had fought him. Silly old women believe the Panjudicator punishes us with defeats and rewards us with victory. I felt I had been given more reward than I desired. A few moments later, he mounted the scaffold, and the brief ceremony began. When it was over, the soldiers forced him to his knees, and I lifted my sword, forever blotting out the sun. When the blade is as sharp as it should be, and the stroke is given correctly, one feels only a slight hesitation as the spinal column parts, then the solid bite of the edge into the block. I would take an oath that I smelled Agilis's blood on the rain-washed air before his head banged into the basket. The crowd drew back, then surged forward against the leveled lances. I heard the fat man's exhalation distinctly, precisely the sound he might have made at climax, when he sweated over some hired woman. From far away came a scream. Adja's voice, as unmistakable as a face seen by lightning. Something in its timbre made me feel she had not been watching at all, but had known, nevertheless,
when her twin died. The aftermath is often more troublesome than the act itself. As soon as the head has been exhibited to the crowd, it can be dropped back into the basket. But the headless body, which remains capable of losing a good deal of blood for a long time after the action of the heart has ceased, must be taken away in a manner dignified yet dishonorable. Furthermore, it must be not just taken away, but taken to some specific spot where it will be safe from molestation. An exultant can, by custom, be laid across the saddle of his own destrier, and his remains are surrendered to his family at once. Persons of lesser rank, however, must be provided with some resting place secure from the eaters of the dead. And at least until they are safely out of sight, they must be dragged. The executioner cannot perform this task because he is already burdened with the head and with his weapon. And it is rare for anyone else involved, soldiers, officers of the court, and so on, to be willing to do so. At the citadel, it was done by two journeymen and thus presented no difficulty. The Kiliar, a cavalryman by training and no doubt by inclination, had solved the problem by ordering that the body should be pulled behind a baggage sumpter. The animal had not been consulted, however, and, being more of the laborer than the warrior kind, took fright at the blood and tried to bolt. We had an interesting time of it, before we were able to get poor Agilis into a quadrangle from which the public was excluded. I was cleaning off my boots when the port-reeve met me there. When I saw him, I supposed he had come to give me my fee, but he indicated that the Kiliarch wished to pay me himself. As I told him, it was an unexpected honor. "He watched everything," the port-reeve said, "and he was quite pleased. He instructed me to tell you that you and the woman who travels with you are welcome to spend the night here, if you wish." "We'll leave at twilight," I told him. "I believe that will be safer." He took thought for a moment, then nodded, showing more intelligence than I would have anticipated. "The miscreant will have a family, I suppose, and friends, though no doubt you know no more of them than I. Still, it's a difficulty you must face frequently." "I have been warned by more experienced members of my guild," I said. I had said that we would leave at twilight, but in the event we waited until it was fully dark, in part for safety's sake, and in part because it seemed wise to eat the evening meal before we left. We could not, of course, make directly for the wall and Thrax. The gate, of whose location I had only a vague idea in any event, would be shut. And I had been told by everyone that there were no inns between the barracks and the wall. What we had to do then was first to lose ourselves and then to find a place where we could spend the night and from which we could go without difficulty to the gate the next day. I had gotten detailed directions from the port-reeve, and though we missed our way, it was some time before we realized it, and we began our walk quite cheerfully. The Kiliarch had tried to hand me my fee instead of casting it on the ground at my feet, as is customary, and I had had to dissuade him for the sake of his own reputation. I gave Dorcas a detailed account of this incident, which had amused me nearly as much as it had flattered me. When I had finished, she asked practically, "He paid you well, then, I suppose?" "More than twice what he should have given for the services of a single journeyman. A master's fee. And, of course, I got a few tips in connection with the ceremony. Do you know, despite all I spent while Agia was with me, I have more money now than I did when I left our tower? I'm beginning to think that by practicing the mystery of our guild while you and I are traveling, I'll be able to support us." Dorcas seemed to draw the brown mantle closer about her.
I was hoping you wouldn't have to practice it again at all, at least not for a long time. You were so ill afterward, and I don't blame you.
It was only nerves. I was afraid that something would go wrong.
You pitied him. I know you did.
I suppose so. He was Adjie's brother. And like her, I think, in everything except sex.
You miss Adjie, don't you? Did you like her so much?
I only knew her for a day. Much less time than I have known you already. If she had had her way, I'd be dead now. One of those two Avernes would have been the end of me.
But the leaf didn't kill you. I still recall the tone she used when she told me that. Indeed, if I close my eyes now, I can hear her voice again and renew the shock I felt as I realized that ever since I had sat up to see Agilis still grasping his plant, I had been avoiding the thought. The leaf had not killed me. But I had turned my mind for my survival, just as a man suffering from a deadly sickness manages by a thousand tricks never to look at death squarely. Or rather, as a woman alone in a large house refrains from looking into mirrors and instead busies herself with trivial errands so that she may catch no glimpse of the thing whose feet she hears at times on the stairs. I had survived, and I should be dead. I was haunted by my own life. I thrust one hand into my cloak and stroked my flesh, gingerly at first. There was something like a scar, and a little caked blood still adhered to the skin. But there was no bleeding and no pain. "They don't kill," I said. "That's all." She said they did. She told a great many lies. We were mounting a gentle hill bathed in pale green moonlight. Ahead of us, seeming as mountains do to be nearer than it was or could possibly be, was the pitch-black line of the wall. Behind us, the lights of Nessus created a false dawn that died bit by bit as the night advanced. I stopped at the top of the hill to admire them, and Dorcas took my arm. So many homes. How many people are there in the city?
No one knows.
And we will be leaving them all behind. Is it far to Thrax, Severian?
A long way, as I've told you already. At the foot of the first cataract. I'm not compelling you to go. You know that.
I want to. But suppose, Severian, just suppose I wanted to go back later. Would you try and stop me?
I said, it would be dangerous for you to try to make the trip alone, so I might try to persuade you not to. But I wouldn't bind or imprison you, if that's what you mean.
You told me you'd written out a copy of the note someone left for me at that inn. Do you remember? But you never showed it to me. I'd like to see it now.
I told you exactly what it said. And it's not the real note, you know. Adjie threw that away. I'm sure she thought that someone, Hildegrin perhaps, was trying to warn me. I had already opened my sabretash. As I grasped the note, my fingers touched something else as well. Something cold and strangely shaped.
Dorcas saw my expression and asked, "What is it?" I drew it out. It was larger than an aura chalk, but not by much, and only a trifle thicker. The cold material, whatever it was, flashed celestine beams back at the frigid rays of the moon. I felt I held a beacon that could be seen all over the city, and I thrust it back and dropped the closure of my sabretash. Dorcas was clasping my arm so tightly, that she might have been a bracelet of ivory and gold grown woman-sized.
What was that?
She whispered. I shook my head to clear my thoughts. It isn't mine. I didn't even know I had it. A gem? A precious stone? It couldn't be. Didn't you feel the warmth? Look at your sword there. That's a gem. But what was that thing you just took out?
I looked at the dark opal on the pommel of Terminus Est. It glowed in the moonlight. But it was no more like the object I had drawn from my saber tash than a lady's glass is like the sun.
The claw of the conciliator, I said. Adjia put it there.
She must have, when we broke the altar, so it would not be found on her person if she was searched.
She and Agilis would have got it again when Agilis claimed victorite. And when I didn't die, she tried to steal it in his cell.
Dorcas was no longer staring at me. Her face was lifted and turned toward the city and the sky glow of its myriad lamps.
Severian, she said. It can't be.
Hanging over the city, like a flying mountain in a dream, was an enormous building. A building with towers and buttresses and an arched roof. Crimson light poured from its windows. I tried to speak, to deny the miracle even as I saw it. But before I could frame a syllable, the building had vanished like a bubble in a fountain, leaving only a cascade of sparks.
Chapter 32. The Play.
It was only after the vision of that great building hanging, then vanishing above the city, that I knew I had come to love Dorcas. We walked down the road, for we had found a new road just over the top of the hill, into darkness. And because our thoughts were entirely of what we had seen, our spirits embraced without hindrance, each passing through those few seconds of vision, as if through a door never previously opened and never to be opened again. I do not know just where it was we walked. I recall a winding road down the hillside, an arched bridge at the bottom, and another road bordered for a league or so by a vagabond wooden fence. Wherever it was we went, I know we talked about ourselves not at all, but only of what we had seen and what its meaning might be. And I know that at the beginning of that walk, I looked on Dorcas as no more than a chance-met companion, however desirable, however to be pitied. And at the end of it, I loved Dorcas in a way that I have never loved another human being. I did not love her because I had come to love Thecla less. Rather, by loving Dorcas, I loved Thecla more, because Dorcas was another self, as Thecla was yet to become in a fashion, as terrible as the other was beautiful. And if I loved Thecla, Dorcas loved her also.
"Do you think," she asked, "that anyone saw it but us?"
I had not considered that. But I said that although the suspension of the building had endured for only a moment, yet it had taken place above the greatest of cities, and that if millions and tens of millions had failed to see it, yet hundreds must still have seen.
"Isn't it possible it was only a vision meant only for us?"
"I have never had a vision, Dorcas. And I don't know whether I've had any or not. When I try to recall the time before I helped you out of the water, I can only remember being in the water myself. Everything before that is like a vision shattered to pieces. Only small bright bits. A thimble I saw laid on velvet once. And the sound of a small dog barking outside a door. Nothing like this. Nothing like what we've seen.
What she said made me remember the note, which I had been searching for when my fingers touched the claw. And that in turn suggested the brown book, which lay in the pleat of my saber-tash next to it. I asked Dorcas if she would not like to see the book that had once been Thecla's, when we found a place to stop.
Yes, she said. When we are seated by a fire again, as we were for a moment at that inn. Finding that relic, which of course I will have to return before we can leave the city. And what we have been saying, too, remind me of something I read there once. Do you know of the key to the universe?
Dorcas laughed softly.
No, Severian. I, who scarcely know my name, do not know anything about the key to the universe.
I didn't say that as well as I should have. What I meant was, are you familiar with the idea that the universe has a secret key? A sentence or a phrase, some say even a single word that can be wrung from the lips of a certain statue or read in the firmament, or that an anchorite on a world across the seas teaches his disciples.
Babies know it, Dorcas said. They know it before they learn to speak, but by the time they're old enough to talk, they have forgotten most of it. At least someone told me that once.
That's what I mean, something like that. The Brown Book is a collection of the myths of the past, and it has a section listing all the keys of the universe, all the things people have said were the secret after they had talked to mystagogues on far worlds or studied the Popol Vuh of the magicians or fasted in the trunks of holy trees. Thecla and I used to read them and talk about them, and one of them was that everything, whatever happens, has three meanings. The first is its practical meaning, what the book calls the thing the plowman sees. The cow has taken a mouthful of grass, and it is real grass, and a real cow. That meaning is as important and as true as either of the others. The second is the reflection of the world about it. Every object is in contact with all others, and thus the wise can learn of the others by observing the first. That might be called the soothsayer's meaning, because it is the one such people use when they prophesy a fortunate meeting from the tracks of serpents or confirm the outcome of a love affair by putting the elector of one suit atop the patroness of another.
And the third meaning? Dorcas asked. The third is the transubstantial meaning.
Since all objects have their ultimate origin in the Pan-Creator, and all were set in motion by him, so all must express his will, which is the higher reality.
You're saying that what we saw was a sign?
I shook my head.
The book is saying that everything is a sign.
The post of that fence is a sign, and so is the way the tree leans across it. Some signs may betray the third meaning more readily than others.
For perhaps 100 paces, we were both silent. Then Dorcas said, "It seems to me that if what the Chatelaine Thecla's book says is true, then people have everything backward. We saw a great structure leap into the air and fall to nothing, didn't we?"
"I only saw it suspended over the city. Did it leap?"
Dorcas nodded. I could see the glimmer of her pale hair in the moonlight. "It seems to me that what you call the third meaning is very clear, but the second meaning is harder to find, and the first, which ought to be the easiest, is impossible." I was about to say I understood her, at least about the first meaning, when I heard from some distance off,
a rumbling roar that might have been a long roll of thunder. Dorcas exclaimed, "What's that?" and took my hand in her own small warm one, which I found very pleasant. "I don't know, but I think it came from the copse up ahead." She nodded. "Now I hear voices."
"Your hearing is better than mine, then."
The rumbling sounded again, louder and more prolonged, and this time, perhaps only because we were a trifle nearer, I thought I saw the gleam of lights through the trunks of the grove of young beeches ahead of us.
"There,"
Dorcas said, and pointed in a direction somewhat to the north of the trees.
"That can't be a star. It's too low and too bright and moves too quickly."
"It's a lantern, I think, on a wagon perhaps, or carried in someone's hand." The rumble came once more, and this time I knew it for what it was, the rolling of a drum. I could hear voices now myself, very faintly, and particularly one voice that sounded deeper than the drum and almost as loud. As we rounded the edge of the copse, we saw about 50 people gathered around a small platform. On it, between flaring torches, stood a giant who held a kettle drum beneath one arm like a tom-tom. A much smaller man, richly dressed, stood on his right, and on his left, nearly naked, the most sensuously beautiful woman I have ever seen.
"Everyone is here,"
the small man was saying loudly and very rapidly.
"Everyone is here. What would you have? Love and beauty?"
He pointed to the woman.
"Strength? Courage?"
He waved the stick he carried toward the giant.
"Deception. Mystery."
He tapped his own chest.
"Vice?"
He pointed toward the giant again.
"And look here.
See who's just come. It's our old enemy, Death, who always comes sooner or later."
With this, he pointed to me, and every face in the audience turned to stare. It was Dr. Talos and Baldanders. Their presence seemed inevitable as soon as I had recognized them. So far as I knew, I had never seen the woman.
"Death!"
Dr. Talos said.
"Death has come. I doubted you these past 2 days, old friend. I ought to have known better."
I expected the audience to laugh at this grim humor, but they did not. A few muttered to themselves, and a crone spat into her palm and pointed 2 fingers toward the ground.
"And who is it he has brought with him?"
Dr. Talos leaned forward to peer at Dorcas in the torchlight.
"Innocence, I believe it is. Yes, it's innocence."
"Now everyone is here. The show will begin in a moment or two. Not for the faint of heart. You have never seen anything like it, anything at all. Everyone is here now."
The beautiful woman was gone, and such was the magnetism of the doctor's voice that I had not noticed when she left. If I were to describe Dr. Talos's play now, as it appeared to me, a participant, the result could only be confusion. When I describe it as it appeared to the audience, as I intend to do at a more appropriate point in this account, I will not perhaps be believed. In a drama with a cast of 5, of whom 2 on the first night had not learned their parts, armies marched, orchestras played, snow fell, and earth trembled. Dr. Talos demanded much from the imagination with narration. Simple yet clever machinery, shadows cast upon screens, holographic projectors, recorded noises, reflecting backdrops, and every other conceivable sleight. And on the whole, he succeeded admirably, as evidenced by the sobs, shouts, and sighs that floated toward us from time to time out of the dark. triumphing in all this, he yet failed. For his desire was to communicate, to tell a great tale that had being only in his mind and could not be reduced to common words. But no one who ever witnessed a performance, and still less we who moved across his stage and spoke at his bidding, ever left it, I think, with any clear understanding of what that tale was. It could only, Dr. Taylor said, be expressed in the ringing of bells and the thunder of explosions, and sometimes by the postures of ritual. Yet as it proved in the end, it could not be expressed even by these. There was a scene in which Dr. Talos fought Baldanders until the blood ran down both their faces. There was another in which Baldanders searched for a terrified Jolenta, that was the name of the most beautiful woman in the world, in a room of an underground palace, and at last seated himself on the chest where she lay hidden. In the final part, I held the center of the stage, presiding over a chamber of inquiry, in which Baldanders, Dr. Talos, Jolenta, and Dorcas were bound in various apparatuses. As the audience watched, I inflicted the most bizarre and ineffective, had they been real, torments on each in turn. In this scene, I could not help but notice how strangely the audience began to murmur while I was preparing, as it seemed, to wrench Dorcas's legs from their sockets. Though I was unaware of it, they had been permitted to see that Baldanders was freeing himself. Several women screamed when his chain clattered to the stage. I looked covertly toward Dr. Talos for directions, but he was already springing toward the audience, having freed himself with far less effort. "Tableau," he called. "Tableau, everyone." I froze in position, having learned that was what was meant. "Gracious people, you have watched our little show with admirable attention. Now we ask a bit of your purse as well as your time. At the conclusion of the play, you will see what occurs now that the monster has freed himself at last." Dr. Talos was holding out his tall hat to the audience, and I heard several coins clink into it. Unsatisfied, he leaped from the stage and began to move among the people. "Remember that once he is free, nothing stands between him and the consummation of his brutal desires. Remember that I, his tormentor, am bound now and at his mercy. Remember that you have never as yet learned, thank you, sir, the identity of the mysterious figure seen by the Contessa through the curtained windows, thank you, that above the dungeon you see now the weeping statue, thank you, still digs under the rowan tree. Come now, you have been very generous with your time. We ask only that you will not be penurious with your money. A few truly have treated us well, but we will not perform for a few. Where are the shining azami that should have showered into my poor hat long ago from the rest of you? The few shall not pay for the multitude. If you've no azamis, then orichalks. If you have none, surely there is no one here without an ease." Eventually a sufficient sum was gathered, and Dr. Talos vaulted back into his place and deftly reaffixed the fastenings that seemed to hold him in an embrace of spikes. Baldanders roared and stretched forth his long arms as though to grasp me, allowing the audience to observe that a second chain, unnoticed previously, still constrained him. "See him," Dr. Talos prompted me sotto voce. "Hold him off with one of the flambeaus." I pretended to discover for the first time that Baldander's arms were free, and plucked one of the torches from its socket at the corner of the stage. At once both torches guttered. The flames, which had been of clear yellow above scarlet, now burned blue and pale green, spitting sparks and sputtering, doubling and tripling and